Hello, everybody, and welcome to 8 Pixel Radio. On today's episode, we have...
Kate. Hi.
Hello, and welcome.
Oh, well, am I here or not? That is the question.
Well, you've already thrown me.
I am calling in from the office of Clio, where I'm a design manager. I'm also a coach, and I work with product designers. And I am very interested in whether or not listeners today believe whether or not I am a bot or whether I am real. We'll let them decide.
Is this because you sound like one or because of the world we live in?
Because of the world we live in.
Okay, perfect. Right. You haven't been some sort of audio on a bot somewhere before?
Not yet.
Okay, well, let's let them figure it out. And let's jump into the first question. You ready? Mm-hmm. Okay. What one song or album can you listen to on repeat?
Cool. I have a song which makes me feel like I'm flying like a bird above the landscape. And I have this really strong visualization of me just having this amazing perspective. And it's called Emerald. And it's by Hopkin. And I don't know if you've seen John Hopkin's work. John Hopkins. It's called Emerald Rush. And whenever I feel like I need some perspective, and I feel like I want to be creative and free and adventurous, I just kind of feel myself going, and I become the bird and I fly, and I use it when I'm doing like design work, brainstorming. It's very racy, kind of electronic music.
This feels kind of atmospheric.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you know what's kind of weird? Is before we did this, I thought, do you know what? I have no idea where Kate's going to go with her music. It's either, in my head, it was either going to be something like atmospheric Scandinavian music or gangster rap. And I didn't know where you were going to be on that spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you say that because I do really like Syrup. And Syrup music is like this like scissor barbershop slow kind of like trip rap stuff. I do quite like that. But I can't listen to that on repeat. I can listen to it like when I'm in the mood. The other area is, do you know the 90s British kind of psychedelic electronic music band, Spongle?
Spongle.
It's a really good name.
Oh, you're really like throwing my music knowledge out the window
it
here.
It's like I just made that band up.
Yeah.
To try and impress you. But they're really good. And I listen to them on Artist Radio on Spotify, and it brings up brilliant, brilliant vibes. As I said, kind of psychedelic electronic, and I could listen to that for hours. Love it.
So on the Hopkins side, where did this arrive to you in your life? How did you find it?
University, art student, living in a house of creatives. There were six of us. We were living in Peckham Rye, London, southeast, and we were having lots of different fusions of music, but the current kind of theme between all of us is we liked electronic.
And I'm presuming, without insulting your age, that this was Peckham before it was Peckham that we know now.
Yes. Peckham at the time was, there were two stabbings a week, was not gentrified. So.
Sign of a good area.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually lived on a road called, wait for it, Bellenden Road.
Oh, my Lord.
People used to say, oh, you live on Bellend. And I'm like, yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm. This is British humour, like check, check and check to all of us. Okay, the next question is actually a random one, which I have not prepared you for. But this is a fun one, Kate. So when you think about the term design thinking, there was an origin to this terminology. When do you think that the term design thinking started to be used?
Commerce. I would say when we started to package it up as consultants.
Would you be able to put a time on this?
No, my dates and numbers are not so good.
Any number?
I would guess when, I mean, we've been packaging up design for a while, maybe in the 90s.
You going 90s?
Yeah, probably earlier. I'm gonna go 50s, but some, yeah.
Are we locking in the 50s?
Oh, I'm uncomfortable now. Yeah, let's do it.
You're right. So it was, it has a history from the 50s and 60s. And this is something I hadn't heard of before, but it has roots in the study of design cognition, design methods as well. But it's also been referred to, and this is another word that kind of sounds made up, referred to as designerly ways of knowing, thinking and acting, and designerly thinking.
I like that more, designerly.
It sounds, you remember when there was a phase where everybody's domain name had .ly at the end?
Yeah.
I reckon somebody's got designer.ly and they are cashing in on this 50, 70-year-old terminology.
Brilliant.
So there you go, design thinking.
So 50s. I could describe myself as being, could I describe myself as a verb? Like I'm being designerly, an adverb, description.
I think it would be designerly ways of doing something.
Okay.
Not necessarily the human, but you can do whatever you want because this word does sound made up. Okay, you ready for the next question?
Yes.
What do you find yourself having to consistently convince other people of?
Oh yeah, I went straight for the jugular with this one. Everybody thinks that the deep and meaningful questions of life are outside of them. And I am constantly, on a daily basis, reminding people that the answers are inside them. And this is very frustrating for many people.
Can you give me an example?
Yes. What career should I do? What are my values? What should I care about? What does success look like? Am I good enough? All of those questions, nobody can answer for you. And yet everybody looks on YouTube, looks on blogs, asks, reads biographies. They're constantly searching for the answer outside. And it takes them sometimes 30 or 40 years to work it out.
How to be productive.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go a little bit deeper into this one. Do you have a theory as to why this happens, why people look for answers outside?
Yeah. I think there's two things. I think one is our natural kind of tribe-like behavior. If we think back to our ancestors, we want to fit in, because if we don't fit in, you literally don't get the protection and security of the tribe and you will be cast out as other. You probably get eaten by a grizzly tiger or something. I think the other one is more modern and is coming from this kind of Fordism or kind of mechanicalization, industrial revolution, where everybody needs to check in and check out as a work person. And they have to go in the same hours and they have to do the same job and it has to be repetitive. And therefore, there's this assumption, there's a cookie cutter approach to everything and everyone, because that's how we build machines and companies. And therefore, humans are just an extension of that. And that's the fallacy, because we're not logical creatures. We're biological.
So do you think that we are, also that phrase is something that needs to go far. Do you think that our lives have basically been turned into machines, apart from like who we fundamentally are as individuals? And we can't find the answers to that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that that's why a lot of people are pretty miserable and depressed. But when they go inside and they ask themselves and they face their emotions and they face their memories and they really, really, really listen to their deep intuition, they find so much peace. They find so much contentment and they're no longer trying to be someone else. They're just being. And to me, there's no greater contentment in life than just being. Yeah, sure, you'll have like stress still. You can't get rid of that. But that kind of deep peace, I think comes from that.
And for people listening who are currently seeking answers on YouTube or BuzzFeed articles or something like that, do you have a a central point of this is where you can start to look more internal?
Yeah. I like the salt metaphor. You know how, like, when you have a nice meal, you just can finish it off by putting a little bit of salt on, and that just makes the meal. But the proportion is very tiny amount of salt to really substantial, huge meal. And I think that's the same with looking for outside reflection. I think that's the right ratio. You spend time thinking about what your meal is, what you care about. Spend more time there and then add a little bit of salt. You know, find out what someone else's perspective is. Go and see how other people think about the thing you've been thinking about. But most people do it in reverse. They spend all the time trying to work out what everyone else is doing, and then they'll have a little sprinkle of their own idea on top.
Particularly in design, I guess, where it's how can I improve my visual design skills? Let me just go and copy someone else's design instead of feeling what you believe that the best experience would be.
Yeah. I think the difficult thing though here is that there is a mechanical repetition of hand-eye coordination and kind of a hard skill, which is less about the deep meaning of life, right? And I think copying other people is a great way to get that eye and taste relationship sharp and quick. So I do still think that practicing watching other people's work and literally copying it, just like the great masters used to do, like Michelangelo, Raphael on the ceiling, you know, painting frescoes, just literally copying the masters. But I think for the deeper meaning question, can't shortcut that.
So would you see the copying the fresco as being the salt in this example?
I think that the salt only applies for deep, meaningful questions. I think when it comes to a design career, there are just some physical things you just have to practice. And we can't avoid that because it's only through practice and practice and practice and practice that we get good at stuff.
Is there a pepper here too?
Ooh. What would the pepper be? So something else to finish off your career. Maybe mentorship and coaching. Because again, it's something complementary. It's pepper is a very good antibacterial and preserves food. So perhaps having someone look out for you and channel your agenda in your and help you to think within what you're looking for is helpful.
Perfect. What a perfect answer to the question.
Nice Thank analogy you. Shift there.
Yeah, we designerly did it.
We designerly did it.
Okay, you ready for the next one?
Yeah.
What's the best thing that you've never worked on?
Best thing I've never worked on. I really like, there's a company called What Design Can Do. Have you heard of them?
No.
They're really cool. They're in Denmark and they set loads of competitions for really big, meaty, juicy design challenges around the world. And you submit your ideas and then they bring a group of people together, the best ideas, to come and solve one or two of them, and the judges decide. And it's amazing what designers can do because they're really amazing advocates for the power of designers coming together from across the globe. And I've seen a couple of the sustainability projects and the challenges they do. And this is the kind of global, collaborative, you know, cross inspiring thinking that I would love to have say I've been a part of, but I haven't.
I feel like I'm hitting this topic a lot recently of designers needing this higher level of purpose rather than kind of just selling software. Mm-hmm. And I've got this kind of hope that over the next few years, there's a transition to more regenerative or sustainable or green, in air quotes, projects and businesses where designers can get involved in and feel like they're actually making a significant difference with the pixels that they're producing. And you're kind of touching on that again. So it feels like there's something circling around, an opportunity. It feels like it's circling around for people to start more of these projects at the moment.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the B Corp certificate has gone wild. It's this tick box exercise. Everyone wants to be a B Corp. For those that don't know, you have a triple bottom line. So a normal company, you just have to optimize as a business for revenue. that's your bottom line. But in a B Corp, you've got these other two, which is you have to prove social impacts and also environmental impacts. It's called triple bottom line. By holding those metrics accountable, by trying to find ways to prove that you are doing social good and you're helping the environment, I feel like there's been this huge wave systematizing that, and how do organizations bring that? And it's a bottom up, it's a groundswell. People care and they want their businesses to care. And I think that's brilliant. It's really exciting.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting. It sounds, I can imagine lots of designers getting excited by the idea of change and having the agency to do that.
It's also tough because It's not glamorous. It sounds glamorous, but then the actual day to day is talking with compliance, dealing with regulations, activism, you know, shipping 3 or 4 iterations that are really bad and not very user-centered, but then eventually getting to something that is and having that long view. So I think designers that go into kind of social impact stuff, they can't expect immediate results. They have to be patient and they have to expect, okay, I'm going to have amazing impact within a few years, like not within a term.
It's one of those things that I can feel that people's response would be, oh, that must be really rewarding.
Yeah. Like in your head.
Yes. Yeah. Like when someone works at a charity and it's very difficult. Or if you're like a teacher, well, that must be really rewarding. But yeah, it's very, very difficult to do.
But no pain, no gain, right? Some of the most amazing things are where you actually sacrifice a bit of yourself. And I'm a firm believer that, you know, a meaningful life is one of service. Like when you're actually serving someone outside of yourself, then you're always going to feel way more, you know, comfortable with life.
Yeah. Again, lovely answer. Thank you. And now we're going to have a word from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by imposter syndrome, because I think we can all agree there's no greater motivator to waking up in the morning, pouring your first cup of coffee, opening the laptop, and getting ready to do some great work than by facing the horror that is a little demon on your shoulder telling you that you're not good enough. Well, hey, listener, guess what? They're right. Of course, I'm only joking. Let's get back on with the show. Kate, what would your last meal be?
My husband is Iranian. And his parents-in-law make amazing Persian food for me.
I'm excited for this.
They have something called osh, and it's this soup filled with noodles, and it has different types of beans, and it has camel curd and all kinds of mint and all kinds of herbs. And it's just a bowl of healing heaven. It's amazing. It's warm.
Is this a seasonal thing?
I don't know. All I know is that my in-laws bring it round every like 3 or 4 months. And I'm like, this is my day. This is the best day of the week.
Do they bring like liters and liters of this stuff?
No, they bring me forth a bowl and they come and knock on the door because we live next door to them. And they bring forth the bowl and I do a little gratitude ceremony, which I'm just like, you're amazing. Thank you so much.
So I was watching something the other day. And it was about how minestrone soup, the people where that originated from, they have it all year, all the time, and it has a significant impact on their health and well-being. Do you think that fits in the line of this, like, as you said, like bowl of health, bowl of goodness that has just been through the generations, passed down, probably the same recipe, people still love it?
Yeah. Definitely some wisdom in there. Something local, maybe something that's easy and cheap, something that's seasonal. Maybe you can change the ingredients as you go. Yeah. I definitely like passed down recipes. I think that's a really cool thing. Because why would you have to go through all those mistakes and learning curves yourself when you can just learn from someone else? It's amazing.
And for this meal, you've only said one thing. So are you having a main dish for your last meal? Is that what's happening here?
It's really filling. It's okay. Like thick noodles, beans. It's really thick and very tasty.
Do you have bread with it?
No, it's just, you could do, but it's so filling.
Do you have any kind of side with it?
Salt and pepper.
Okay, are you going to have a drink with this?
Well, if I was going to be going Persian, I would have something called Sikanjabin, which is a healing drink as well. They're obviously the world's biggest apothecary. They have amazing medicine, alternative medicine. And it's a little bit of red grape vinegar, a little bit of mint syrup, and then a little bit of honey. And you mix that all with warm water. It must be 60 degrees so it doesn't kill off the honey amazingness. And you mix it all up and it opens my husband's lungs. He's got asthma. And his life is a better quality life because he drinks that drink.
Does it taste good?
Yes. Sweet.
It's got vinegar in it.
You can't really taste that. It's like a very small amount.
That does sound, I've never come across that. But it does sound medicine-y and kind of something you'd be given as a child.
It doesn't taste like medicine. It just tastes like a honey drink.
And do they sell this on the streets? Is this?
I think it's mostly just handmade. You just make it at home. But I do think that more people should know about it because it's really makes you feel good.
You know what? It's probably one of those things that some San Francisco startup will find and raise $10 million.
Yes, like kombucha and kefir. Those are in the same vein, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Someone's going to find this and they'll take it global and then you'll be upset because your homely recipes have been exposed to the world.
I would be very happy, actually, because I think more people should benefit from cheap, affordable preventative medicine rather than reactionary stuff, which only happens when you're kind of, you know, losing an arm or on the verge of death.
What a lovely way to end that question. We have come to our final question, which is, what is your favorite curse word?
I've got quite a few, but I think my favorite one is pants.
That is probably the most English answer I've ever been given.
Obviously, our American friends, so that means trousers. But in the UK, it means knickers.
Or underwear.
Yeah. So I mean, I have nothing against underwear. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean to use that lovely garment in bad context. But I just find it lighthearted and a bit silly. And I feel like even for myself, it just diffuses my tension when I say it.
And is it something you say a lot?
Yeah. The other one is bummer. Oh, bummer.
Bummer.
But with my English accent.
Yeah. Are there any actual swear words?
Just a classic F word.
Okay. I can feel like we're going in levels of like gradation.
That's not very exciting though, is it? It's just a great go-to. It's very versatile as a word. You can use it as pretty much any part of a sentence. Yes. It's got a lot going for it.
Just like pants.
Pants is less versatile.
I'm sure you're sitting there sometimes and your design isn't going as it should and you're throwing this around, insulting the software.
Pants.
In like a whispered tone.
It's very, yeah, exactly. Whispering it like it's the rudest word on the planet. But it's very work safe as well.
You're not going to get in trouble with that.
Right. And us British, we love to swear. But again, across the pond, it's frowned upon a bit. So got to be careful.
It does. And this always been, I can imagine you doing this as a child as well.
I don't know, you know, Louis. I don't know.
It would work. It would be safe. So any 7-year-olds listening, if you want to swear, you can use that one. All right. Well, that's our questions. That went by very quickly. Thank you so much. We went in some places there. We spoke about B Corps. We spoke about pants. We spoke about vinegar. We kind of went all around the world.
And that the answers to life are inside you.
Exactly. A little bit of salt. Thanks again, Kate.
Thank you.